My name is Jim Hires. If you don't know me, I'm the executive director of the East Illinois Food Bank. And thank you so very, very much for being here. You know, this is the fifth symposium that we've done. We were reflecting today how it's changed and how it's the dynamics have changed over the last 5 years. 5 years ago, we were strictly interested in getting food into the warehouse and getting it out to people. In fact, food banking has changed a great deal in the last 5 to 10 years. Food banking began as a way to rescue food that would have been thrown away and then get it in the hands of either soup kitchen shelters or food pantries. But over a period of time, partnerships began to be formed with organizations and other food programs to not just provide food, but also provide some other kinds of things, like building stronger communities through programs like food stamps and through our other programs that we work with. So tonight we're trying to look at what food banking does, what we do in our community that's tied to those programs that make a safety net really, really viable. We believe that what we do as food bankers is provide a safety net, but we can't do that anymore by ourselves. It's been very, very evident. I was fortunate or unfortunate, which way you want to look at it, I spent the afternoon with the Illinois Commission to Eliminate Poverty. As one of the commissioners, we've been holding hearings for the last 3 years, and we were doing our annual report meeting today. And we found out that we thought we were going to reduce extreme poverty by one half by 2015. So when we started the program 3 years ago, we had high hopes. The number of people in extreme poverty in the state of Illinois has risen 200,000. We're going the wrong direction, which is going to make what we do even more important and put a strain on that. So we're very, very pleased that you're here. And thank you. And throughout the evening, I hope you hear more about what we do. We do serve 100,000 people annually in 14 counties, which is an amazing thing. And we're proud of what we do. But more importantly, we're proud of our relationships within the communities that make that happen. So I'm going to introduce Brenda Kester, who is going to be our moderator tonight. Brenda is the associate director, assistant director at the Family Resiliency Center at the University of Illinois. And her work centers around research and disseminating research findings. She also teaches. She's been an advocate for children's education for the last 16 years. And since I've known her for about the last 4 years, she's been a strong advocate for childhood hunger and childhood food insecurity. And please join me in welcoming Brenda Kester.
Welcome. I'm pleased to be here tonight with you. Just a few housekeeping things. You do, unfortunately, the parking is not free until 9 o'clock, so you do need to feed those meters. Also, at the volunteers, and I'd like you guys, Kathleen, Sabrina, Ryan, they are going to be, there should be a card in your packet. So if you have any questions for the panelists, go ahead and write that down anytime that occurs to you. We're going to have a time at the end of the session for you to respond to those. Bathrooms are just around the corner. We are talking about food insecurity, but we don't want to be food insecure. Thanks to Chef Benjamin, there will be refreshments provided at the end of the event, although water and coffee is available now. So feel free to help yourself. I'd like to start out by introducing our panelists, who we'll hear from in a little bit. Melissa Kundari is a program specialist in the SNAP Policy Unit for the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service Midwest Regional Office. She holds a BS in psychology and an MS in Human Service Administration. Her background includes administering TFAT, SNAP Outreach, and SNAP Nutrition Education for the state of Illinois, and developing the SNAP Outreach and Policy Program at Feeding America. She now oversees SNAP policy at the federal level for Illinois and Ohio. Tracy Smith, and I'd also like to thank them both who drove down from Chicago to be here for us tonight, so we appreciate that. Tracy Smith directs Feeding America, the State Association of Feeding America Food Banks in Illinois. Did I say Feeding Illinois? Yes. Feeding America's been on my mind. Feeding Illinois coordinates the collaborative efforts of the 8 member food banks, including SNAP Outreach, food sourcing, and communications and advocacy. Tracy's an attorney with 20 years of experience in policy, advocacy, and program management. Her prior roles include serving as the director of the League of Women Voters of Chicago and as Inspector General for the Illinois Tollway. In March of 2011, she was appointed by Governor Quinn to serve on the Illinois Commission to End Hunger. Jason Wetzel is the Director of Government Relations for Walmart in Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, and Kentucky, and he lives in Indianapolis, Indiana. Before joining Walmart in 2006, Jason lobbied on behalf of the Ohio Grocers Association. Walmart recently pledged $2 billion in donated food and grants to fight hunger in America as part of its Fighting Hunger Together initiative. Locally, Walmart has been a major funder of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank's SNAP outreach program to help connect families to food stamp benefits, as well as the SNAP outreach work of many other Feeding Illinois member food banks statewide. Local Walmart stores have also donated tens of thousands of pounds of nutritious food to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and its member agencies through the retail pickup program. Last, I want to introduce Craig Gunderson, who is a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois. He's also executive director of the National Soybean Research Laboratory. Craig is also a member of the Technical Advisory Group of Feeding America and is the lead researcher on the Map the Meal Gap project. Previously, he was at the Economic Research Service of the USDA and at Iowa State University. Craig's research concentrates in four main areas: examining the efficacy of food assistance programs, analysis of the determinants of food insecurity and food assistance participation, examinations of measurement issues pertaining to food insecurity and food assistance participation, and analysis of the effects of food insecurity and stress on childhood obesity. You will thank me when I just say his work has been published in a lot of journals, and I don't read them all. His work has been supported by over $15 million in external funding from various government and non-government sources. To start us off for the evening, Craig's going to be providing us with an overview of food insecurity in Eastern Illinois, drawing on his work from the Map the Meal Gap.
Okay, I wanted to begin by thanking Eastern Illinois Food Bank for inviting me to do this. I love the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, so whenever I have the opportunity to work with them, I'm really pleased about that. And it's especially nice tonight that my daughter, who's way in the back, she actually came to see me present tonight. She hasn't seen me present various stuff before, so I'm very pleased about that. And I want to thank Brenda for the introduction. Brenda and Barbara Feast have been great at the Family Resiliency Center about raising issues of hunger in our community, so I wanted to thank that. They're two of my favorite people at University of Illinois, so I'm very happy that you all are supportive of this. And it's great to be on a panel of people from FNS, Feeding America, and from Walmart, three great organizations which are leading the fight against hunger in the United States, all in various capacities. So let me now begin with my presentation. And the title of my talk is Alleviating Food Insecurity in Eastern Illinois. So in concentrating upon this, I'm going to begin with some very specific information about Eastern Illinois. Oh, and I wanted to thank all of you for coming tonight. I really did want to thank all of you. I know there's lots of other things you could be doing with your time, so I really appreciate you coming to this to learn more about issues of hunger and for supporting the work of Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So I'm going to be drawing on this, as Brenda mentioned, the Map the Meal Gap research for Eastern, with specific results for Illinois and then for Eastern Illinois Food Bank service area. So in doing, and then I'm going to draw out some broader implications for one of the food assistance programs that are alleviating hunger in the area is SNAP. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some more general things for that and draw it down to the local level. So beginning with, I wanted to talk about how we define food insecurity. All of you understand well the ramifications of hunger and everything, but I want to talk briefly about how exactly we define it. It's based upon responses to 18 questions in what's called the core food security module. And these are examples of some of the questions that are posed. Some are, The least severe question is, I worried about whether our food would run out before we got money to buy more. One of the manifestations of food insecurity is stress and worry about your situation. The most severe, thankfully, it's a very severe thing that we see rarely in the United States, is did a child in the household ever not eat for a full day because you couldn't afford enough money for food? Fortunately, this is rare, but that's the most severe thing. So these 18 questions, these are four examples. And we say a household is food insecure if they respond affirmatively to three or more of the 18 questions. And there's other categories. But what I'm talking about today is, when we talk about food insecurity, is we talk about people who respond affirmatively to three or more of these 18 questions. So here is the results from the Map the Meal Gap. And for those of you who are interested, is you can go to the Feeding America website, and they have all the information on Map the Meal Gap. So if you're interested in any county in the United States, is you can ascertain what their food insecurity level is. And this is for both overall food insecurity rates and for child food insecurity rates. And it has a lot more details about how these estimates are calculated and various other executive summary, technical brief, all sorts of interesting stuff there. So here is what you get for if you look at Illinois. What you see is that they give information on the food insecurity rate for Illinois and then for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank service area. So in Illinois, is 14.7% of the population is food insecure. So first I'm going to talk about the full population. So this is about the average for the United States. Illinois is about midway there. But when you think about it, 14.7% is a lot. But when you put in numbers, almost 2 million people in Illinois are suffering from food insecurity. So when you put in those magnitudes, it really illustrates the serious problem that we face in our state. Oh, that's bad. That was fine. So the food insecurity rate then for Eastern Illinois Food Bank area is listed here. It's 15.6%, slightly higher than for the state as a whole, but we can think about it being roughly the same as the rest of the state. And as you've seen in the advertisements for this event and for other things, is that translates into almost 80,000 people in our community suffering from food insecurity. These are large numbers, in my opinion, things that we have to address. So this gives you an overview of food insecurity in both Illinois and in the Eastern Illinois Food Bank service area. Two other things I want to point out about this. We're going to be talking a lot about SNAP today. 40% of the population in Illinois is below the SNAP threshold of 130% of the poverty line. In other words, 4 out of 10 people who are food insecure can access the services of SNAP. 40% of those who are food insecure, though, are ineligible for any food assistance programs. I'd love to extol all the virtues of Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This is one of the key things. This group of people here, the only source they can turn to is the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So, and we can talk more about what the policy response to this, but in today's world, this Eastern Illinois Food Bank is the bulwark of the safety net for those persons. So this is for the full population. Now I want to talk about child food insecurity rate. So this is for the number of children who are in households that are food insecure. And as we, for various reasons we may expect, is this rate is higher than for the full population. Okay, almost 1 in 4 children in Illinois are food insecure, roughly 750,000 children, and about 1 in 4 children in the Eastern Illinois Food Bank are food insecure. And so this one of the advantages of the Map the Meal Gap is it really gave us some precise figures for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank area. Because I think there used to be signs up which said 1 in 6 children on those billboards
last year.
In reality, it's 1 in 4 children in our community are suffering from food insecurity. So I think that this is one of the advantages to this, to be able to point this out. And here what we look at is, again, 4 in 10 children are likely ineligible for the National School Lunch Program. The National School Lunch Program is an important component of the safety net for children. 4 in 10 of those children are food insecure, can't access this program. Again, pointing to the importance of Eastern Illinois Food Bank in alleviating hunger in our community. So now what I've done here is I've broken this down by county. So these are the I hope I didn't miss any counties. I don't think I did. These are the 14 counties you serve, correct? You serve 14 counties, okay. Yeah. So these are the 14 counties that are served, and what we have in this column is the overall food insecurity rate and the child food insecurity rate. And as you may not be much of a surprise, for those of you familiar with the challenges being faced in Vermilion County, is they have the highest overall food insecurity rate of 17.8%. So this is predominantly, you know, the Danville area. So we have high food insecurity rates there. If anybody here is from Piatt County, is you have the lowest food insecurity rate. So one of the things this points out, and I can't speak for Jim or Cheryl or anybody else, but this points out one of the challenges of Eastern Illinois Food Bank. They serve a wide variety, I mean, of challenges. Piatt is that pronounced it Piatt? Piatt, okay. Is, you know, 11.1%. Vermilion is 17.8%. The challenge is Piatt, yeah, they're better off. But look, over one in 10 persons in that community is still food insecure. So presenting some of the challenges that facing the wide diversity of challenges across here. Now, when we look at the child food insecurity rate, now child food insecurity rate is not the, you know, is a different measure. And we see as Crawford actually has the highest food insecurity rate when we look at just children. So if we isolate just on children, Crawford has the highest rate of food insecurity amongst children. Surprisingly, at least I was surprised by this, and I made an error here. I wrote down Piatt has the lowest rate for children, but in reality, actually, it's Champaign. Champaign has the lowest rate of food insecurity rate amongst children in our area. Okay, so in contrast to, say, Vermilion, it's 29.0. Now, I mean, that's nice that Champaign has a relatively lower, for whatever reason, has a lower rate of food insecurity. I can go into some of the details why I think that is. But one of the reasons is, but we should still note, over 1 in 5 children in Champaign are food insecure. So we can't be too pleased with it, but at least I guess not as high as it could be. Okay, so this gives us some information about the Eastern Illinois Food Bank service area and all the things, since you can ask me questions later on about this or the other people on the panel about this. Now what I want to talk about is what can we do to address this? And Jim, and I'm not going to talk about all the great things Eastern Illinois Food Bank is doing. I'm not going to talk about all the other really neat food assistance programs we have in the United States today. I'm going to talk about one of them. I'm going to talk about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which still is better known by the food stamp program, but it's been SNAP since what, 2008? Since 2008, so. Okay, so a bit of background on it. We have to remember this, and I'm going to emphasize this again and again and again. Well, that's only one time tonight. I mean, it's pointless to kind of say it over and over again. But is the main goal of this program is to alleviate hunger in the United States. This program was set up to alleviate hunger, and you think things are bad now, you should have seen how bad they were before this program was implemented. In parts of Appalachia and parts of Mississippi Delta, we had people suffering from serious problems with malnutrition. The SNAP has been a wonderful program, and it's met this goal of alleviating hunger and improving the well-being of poor people across the United States. It only began on a nationwide basis in 1974, and the way it works is people are issued, called food stamps, because people actually used to get coupons, which looked like, I got about 5 more minutes, right? Okay. People used to get coupons, which looked kind of like stamps, and then you would put them at the grocery store. Now what it is people have what's called an EBT card. In Illinois, it's known as the link card. And so people swipe it, and that's how you get your benefits. You can only use this in approved retail outlets, and you can only purchase food with these benefits. You can't purchase, say, diapers, or they also have some rules, like you can't purchase rotisserie chickens. I mean, they have little rules like that. So there's some restrictions. But in the main, any food item people want to purchase, they can purchase. Okay. So this is a huge program. It serves 40 million Americans today. I mean, even just as few as, I think, 4 years ago, I think it was serving like 25 million. I mean, it's been a huge increase in the number of people receiving benefits through this program. It's huge in terms of size, and about 60% of recipients are children. So this is really a key part of the social safety net for children in our country. And food stamps, SNAP is set, it's inversely related to income. So if somebody has a higher income, they get fewer benefits. If it's lower income, you get more benefits. But the size of the program for families is non-trivial. The maximum somebody can receive for a family of four is $668. So this is a nice sum of money for people who are on the edge, and the average is about almost $300 for a family of four. So this is a big program, both in terms of the number of people who are getting it, but also in terms of the size of the benefit. It's the largest near-cash assistance program in the United States. Okay? When we think of social safety net, we have to think about SNAP, and we have to think about ways to preserve that safety net. I'm going to come to that momentarily. Okay, so what's the eligibility criteria? This comes back to the point I was making earlier about income breakdowns, about who's eligible for SNAP and who's not eligible, is you have to be below 130% of the poverty line to be eligible for SNAP. Then there's what's called the net income test, and it's your net monthly income after various deductions less than the poverty line. So when we think about who's getting SNAP, is these are families, I think that for a family of four, you have to have an income below roughly, was it $27,000, $28,000 a year to be eligible for this program. So when we think about who's getting benefits from this program, it's a low-income population. Not only people have to be income poor, but you also have to be asset poor. But I think that, is Illinois now waiving the?
No more
asset. Okay, no more asset tests in Illinois. Some states still have, but Illinois does not have an asset test, so you can scratch that as a test. But just in case I'm from another state, then you can still have that. So just scratch that last one. But it's to Illinois' credit, because not every state has waived the asset requirements. So it's to the credit of those of you who have asked your legislators to get rid of the asset test and supported people who got rid of the asset test. So this is a good thing for Illinois. Illinois should be happy with this. I'm going to talk about how we should encourage efforts to increase participation in SNAP, and we should discourage efforts to decrease participation in SNAP. I'm speaking as Craig Gunderson. I'm kind of like University of Illinois person, but I'm an economist, and I have strong feelings about poverty and hunger. So please, don't say this guy from Illinois said. Anyway, so I'm going to make some comments about some of the things I think we should do. About one in three eligible persons do not participate in SNAP. We want to bring these people into the program. There's a lot of money being left on the table. Okay? A lot of money being left on the table for Illinois. If people came into Illinois and got these SNAP benefits, that would be a huge boon to the economy. So we're leaving money on the table. So how do we get people to participate in SNAP? In other words, we want the benefits, that put it in quotes, to exceed the cost because we're thinking more broadly about the benefits and the cost. But one thing is to increase benefit levels, and I would actually try to do things strategically such that we can increase benefit levels, and I can talk more about what I would do with that. The other thing is to reduce stigma. There's a lot of stigma associated with SNAP. Anything we can do as a society to make people aware that using the SNAP is really a great thing, and I think that there's many things we can do as a society to do that. And then we can also reduce transaction costs. Can I go over the two more things? You sure? Okay. So it takes a long time oftentimes to get SNAP benefits. It can take a bit long wait, and so we reduce those. I'm a huge fan of SNAP, and I always frust- and SNAP comes under attack from the right, and it comes under attack from the left. And so we have to figure out ways that we can preserve this great program. It comes under one thing that's been proposed in the Congress is for block granting. Is they've talked about block granting SNAP. In other words, instead of making this an entitlement program, where even during bad economic times, anybody can get it, is they've talked about block granting it. That would not be a good, if we think the SNAP is a key part of the social safety net, is that during times of need, the program would not expand. Like I said, it increased by about 50%. If it's block granted, it's more difficult to increase benefit levels. Okay? So this is something that's been proposed. You can think lots of advantages to block granting. It gives states more flexibility, so I don't want to immediately dismiss this, but from that standpoint. Is that, that's as clear as, okay. Okay. Another thing that's come under attack is some, those crazy New Yorkers have been talking about placing restrictions on food choices. Is they've said, SNAP participants, we're going to restrict what you can do. You can't purchase Gatorade for your children. You can't purchase fruit juices. They're talking about imposing all these restrictions on what people purchase. And this is really a bad thing to do because it'll cause the following to happen, is they will reduce the number of people participating. Like I said, this is a great program. It's alleviated hunger. Why mess with something that works so great? But these, firstly, they've been putting things in other places too, but in New York is, if these were imposed, is whenever you limit people's choices, they're less likely to participate in the program. You impose these restrictions on what's going to happen, hunger rates are going to go up in the United States. Second thing is, like I said before, we want to reduce stigma. You don't want to impose more stigma on people saying, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. We don't want to. We want to reduce stigma. So I guess I would say the two things is I would encourage, as a researcher, SNAP is doing great stuff. I'd encourage you to continue to support along that. And also, I think just in terms of alleviating hunger and things in our community, as a member of a community, I would encourage you also to support efforts to increase SNAP and to resist efforts that might decrease participation in SNAP. I apologize for going over. Thank you very much.
See, if all college professors were that interesting, think of how much fun it would have been in all those classes. So I want to start out by asking, directing a question to you, Melissa.
Sure.
What kind of government-supported food assistance programs are there, and what do they do, and who do they help?
Well, I don't know how I can follow Craig's presentation, but I will try. We have a total of 15 programs that the Food Nutrition Service administers. SNAP is our largest program. Some of the other ones that you will be familiar with is school lunch, school breakfast, WIC. We also have school milk, which is a very small little program, but it provides, if a child is over the eligibility amount for school lunch, they could get, you know, at least a milk with their meal that they purchased. We also have CAACFP, CSFP, and food distribution on Indian reservations, and I think I mentioned the bulk of them. Most of our programs are designed to help families. We have WIC is for women and children. SNAP is for everyone, anyone that meets the eligibility requirements. School lunch, school breakfast, school programs are obviously mostly for children. We consider ourselves the nation's first line of defense against hunger. We realize as the federal government, we cannot do this alone. We rely on the state to directly administer the programs and community-based organizations like the Eastern Illinois Food Bank to reach out further into the community and help reach those people who aren't coming directly to us. We realize that our programs have eligibility limits, so which is a concern that there are people that are hungry, and in an ideal world we would be out of business, as well as the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. We have eligibility limits. There, anytime you're administering bureaucratic federal programs, there's going to be access issues. The state of Illinois and, as I said before, the state of Illinois and community-based organizations play a vital role, and we rely on them to really make people aware of our programs and make sure that the people who are eligible are accessing our programs.
Great. Thank you. Tracy, how is Feeding Illinois involved in SNAP and TFAP?
Feeding Illinois is the state food bank association. So Eastern Illinois Food Bank is one of the 8 food banks that make up the membership of the organization. The network, the 8 food banks, have a network of 2,000 pantries, shelters, and kitchens that they distribute through. In 2010, they distributed 127 million pounds of food in the state of Illinois. One thing that we know, though, is that the safety net is really woven together. It's private, it's state, it's federal. Federal is by far the largest piece of the pie, but as Professor Grinnison pointed out, there are a lot of people that are left out of that part of the safety net. Fully 40% of the food insecure don't qualify for those programs. So it's critical that the private response and the things that are going on in the pantries are able to meet that need. So as many people as we can help to access the SNAP program, that frees up the pantries to provide services to those who don't necessarily qualify. Also, we know from research that SNAP benefits don't last the entire month. On average, they last about 2.5 weeks. So SNAP is an important way to relieve some of the pressure on pantries. As was mentioned earlier, I'm on the Commission on Hunger, and we've been around the state in the last few months, and universally in every community we're in, whether it's urban, suburban, rural communities, we hear the same stories. It's never been this bad. They've never served this many people, and their shelves have never been this empty. TFAP's being cut back. So it's important that we have some other resources to bring into the pantries. It's hard to look your neighbor in the face and say, I'm sorry, we just don't have enough this week. We can't give you anything to take home. So SNAP outreach was a natural fit for the food banks. They already have this network. It was a great way to maximize their use and their reach into that community. We have a state grant through Feeding Illinois. We are on a contract. The state has a plan, and they have several nonprofit organizations that are on it that helps do outreach into the community. We help educate people about benefits. We help them apply for benefits. Last year, we helped almost 2,700 people apply, bringing in an estimated $6.7 million in SNAP benefits, which is the equivalent of about 9 million pounds of food. So really efficient for us. We also do a lot of advocacy around SNAP, trying to protect SNAP. both at the federal level around the federal budget issues, trying to maintain SNAP an appropriate level, reduce barriers to SNAP, and also at a state level through the administration of the program with the Illinois Department of Human Services.
Great. Thank you. Jason, why has Walmart decided to be a supporter of SNAP outreach in work in Illinois?
Well, I think it goes back to we're a retailer at the end of the day, and the reason that we became involved with hunger a few years ago and made the commitment is they're everyone's customers. But as the nation's largest grocer, we saw a very unique role that we could play if we got involved in helping to fight hunger and working on to support programs such as SNAP. So, because I mean, if you look at it, for the last 50 years, folks have viewed hunger pretty much the same. It's charity. And we thought that we could add a unique perspective to it from a business standpoint because of our position. So we took a multi-tiered approach to this. Nationwide, through our foundation, we reached out to the food banks across the country and started doing a listening tour like you've been doing in Illinois and asked them, what do you need? How can we improve how you help your customers? And the biggest issue that we heard was they're not getting enough access to healthy foods, nutritional foods that are fresh produce and fresh meat. Well, that's a no-brainer because we have that in our stores, and we want to get that to folks, and we can make those donations, but the food banks weren't in a position to take it. They didn't have refrigerated trucks. So in the last 18 months, we've given away 150 refrigerated trucks across the country, and we're continuing to do that. And so far, I'm going to look at my notes too. That 40% of the food we donate is grocery and produce, and proteins are 15% of that. We saw an opportunity to get involved as far as the healthy foods. We have a federal team in Washington, D.C., and they worked diligently on some of the issues before, you know, the USDA to make sure that, as Craig mentioned, there is talk about eliminating the access to what foods folks can get. We think there's another alternative there, and that's the one we're advocating, is our healthy nutrition partnership with the First Lady, is rather than telling people what they can and can't have, we've taken a position to work with manufacturers to reduce the sodium and the fat in some foods to make foods healthier, not to mention to petition the federal government to add more healthy foods to the list of SNAP-eligible items. So it's been a 1-2 effort on the federal level. It's funny, we found that when we did this pilot testing, so we go to a manufacturer, let's say of peanut butter, just making up an example, and they drastically reduced the sodium or the fat in peanut butter too quickly, customers stopped buying it. They immediately could tell something happened. So then we had to go back and work, and now it's a work in progress, and those numbers are being gradually reduced so that none of us wake up in the morning and put the peanut butter on and don't like it. But, you know, we're in a position, because we're a fairly large company, to help spur some of that. A private enterprise, that's the role that they can play. I think there's an opportunity, of course, for government agencies and nonprofits. But when you involve business, I think that's the third leg of the stool to make an impact. And here locally, so we have a federal approach, and then we have a state approach. So they entrust folks like me, believe it or not, to work with folks like Tracy, and I remember it was, I think it was last summer, we were talking on the phone, and I said, now, if you could do anything in Illinois, let's say you have a pet project or something that you think could have a huge, make a difference, what would it be? You tell me. And that's where we talked about the SNAP outreach and her, through Feeding Illinois, getting boots on the ground to reach out to the food pantries across the state. And that's an initiative that Walmart helped support. Because we see, as Craig mentioned, we've seen the impact that it's having on our customers. We were seeing it before a lot of folks were reading it in the newspaper. Illinois has made the great step of staggering when folks' benefits are reloaded onto their carts. In states where they're not,
or they're not staggered throughout the month, and they get reloaded at 12:01 on the first of the month. We had folks lined up at the registers with full carts, knowing in 5 minutes their cart was going to go live and they were going to go home and feed their families. We also saw that at the beginning of the month they were buying 30 packs of diapers. And then at the end of the month, they were trying to buy the smallest quantity of every product they possibly could because everything was trickling down. Now we've seen that the stress has only increased. I'll leave it at that. But the one, you know, when I talked about trying to think out of the box and do things differently, another neat project that we did was because we have a great logistics team and Walmart is known for their logistics, we went to the food banks with our folks who run our distribution centers, which are pretty efficient, and we audited some eligible food banks around the country to see what they could do to improve their heating, their lighting, a number of things to improve their energy efficiency. And then when we figured out what those food banks needed, we then awarded them the money to get that work done. And we had contract engineers, you know, come in and do the work. The grants themselves were nominal when you think about it. It was like, I could be wrong, $64,000 to get this work done to retrofit these food banks. I was in Indianapolis a couple weeks ago, and they said that this is one of the food banks that did this, that it doubled their savings per year. To be able to save all that energy, they put that money back into reaching out to the folks who are coming to the food banks, and it's paying for itself perpetually. It was a one-time grant that increased what they could do for the folks that we're all trying to help.
Thank you. So there seems to be so many public and private food assistance programs, and yet we hear people are still going hungry. Those are pretty alarming numbers that Craig was telling us about. What do we need to do to make sure that everyone's fed? And I don't know who wants to take this.
I can start. Speaking from the SNAP perspective, SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So the amount of benefits that a family gets per month is not designed to feed them for the entire month. And as Tracy pointed out, in fact, it doesn't. And there are also eligibility limits, as I said before, on SNAP. So, for example, if you are here legally, but you're a non-citizen and you've been here for less than 5 years, you are ineligible for SNAP. When your income is taken into account to figure out whether you're eligible or not, that income is what you get before taxes are taken out. So if you gross $650 a month, but your check really looks like $400 a month, the budget is $650 a month. And so I think that there are solutions for hunger that involve a myriad of things. For some, they need SNAP and the food pantries. For some, a once-a-month food pantry stop is what's meeting their needs. And for many, both of those programs are not enough. We also realize that a lot of people are eligible that are not participating, and that's another reason for the food insecurity. And we also are aware that there are access issues. Getting on SNAP is in times difficult. And I heard someone say this one time, and I truly believe it, is that being poor takes a lot of time, takes a lot of time out of your day. And there are challenges of getting to the offices, and there are challenges of trying to call your caseworker and these transaction costs that Craig had said. And some people don't have a lot of people don't have the capacity, whether it be the physical capacity, the mental capacity, to quote unquote jump through the hoops. But as a federal program, we have to ensure that our program is has as much integrity as possible. And by maintaining an integrity, that does sometimes, unfortunately, mean some obstacles for the client to get through.
I would say, working on the Commission to End Hunger, one of our commissioner said something. We had a commission meeting earlier today, and I ran from there to be here. But one of them said, I've been doing housing for all these years, and housing is housing, whatever community you go to. But the thing I've learned about hunger is that in every community, access to food is a different challenge. So when we went to East St. Louis, what we learned was they had two grocery stores in the entire city that had fresh produce, and they were across the street from each other. And they have a very poor transportation infrastructure. When we were in Cairo, Illinois, we learned that they had one retail outlet. It's a small, independently owned chain store with no capacity to really support hunger. And unfortunately, a lot of times in rural communities, the hunger response comes from local business. And if there isn't local business, if there isn't local retail who can provide those resources, then those resources don't exist in that community. So I think that what we're learning is that our solutions have to be very community-based. We see real opportunities to coordinate better the work that we're doing. We see some real challenges in a state government that at the same time it is serving larger and larger numbers of people, it is losing funding. We also see real ripple effects from funding cuts in other areas. So when Medicaid gets cut, that means that grandma and grandpa have to spend that money on their medicine, and they don't have money for food, and now they're going to come to the shelters. So I think we have some real challenges. I think that what we're seeing is there are some opportunities in some of the federal nutrition programs to utilize them more fully. So SNAP in Illinois is utilized at 80%. If we can add 20% of people to that, we are 46th in the nation in providing school breakfast. We could probably do better than that. 15% of children who get school lunch get summer food service program. So there are some entitlement programs that we can do a better job of utilizing. We also need to protect those entitlement programs, though, because many of them are on the chopping block with Farm Bill.
So, yeah, is there anyone else? I think that leads into one of the other questions, which is, we've alluded to tonight, there's a general feeling of public skepticism around government-run programs. And so why should taxpayers continue to invest in large public nutrition programs? Do you want to? I know you have no feelings about this. So.
No, we. Have, I mean, I guess it is working. No, I think that these federal programs, we have to remember how great they are. People always talk about, oh, fraud. If I had a nickel for every time I was heard from people, oh, I was at the grocery store the other day, somebody was using food stamps and buying bad stuff. The thing I don't think we realize is how great these programs, how many millions of people that these programs are saving from hunger in the United States. Yeah, they all have their imperfections. We all would probably make a few changes to SNAP. We'd all make a few changes to the National School Lunch Program. But one thing we can't forget is really how great these programs are. And I don't think people would want to live in a country without SNAP, National School Lunch Program, School Breakfast Program, WIC, and all these other great programs that, yeah, no, nothing's perfect, but they're doing a fantastic job. And so every time I think in times of need, we shouldn't be looking to ask those who least can do so to suffer for whatever reason. So I think we need to continue to support these programs. So the other thing is research after – extensive research has demonstrated how great these programs work, especially in alleviating hunger in the United States. So I don't think we can forget that. So the next time somebody complains about some issue with SNAP, just say, yeah, but you're forgetting about how great these programs are in alleviating hunger.
Hunger has a cost. Children who don't eat properly don't do as well in school, and they're not equipped to succeed and provide for themselves. Elderly people who don't get their medication get sick more often. They don't absorb their medication as well. Children who don't get proper nutrition suffer more health problems throughout their lives. Even short periods of food insecurity have long-lasting effects on people. So it's not like, well, we just won't pay for this, and then it's a zero-sum game. We're going to pay for it on the back end through people who aren't equipped to provide for themselves, for people who have more health problems and come into our emergency rooms. So it's not like we can not invest in these programs and then that's okay, we just don't think about it. We have to. It's frustrating to hear that conventional wisdom about, you know, people who game the system. I think that USDA has done a tremendous job in reducing fraud. They have, during a time when demand has gone up and up and up, they have brought down the error rate significantly across the country. They have a robust retail program that combats retail fraud. I think there are a lot of those anecdotal stories about, you know, I heard that my cousin's uncle's nephew saw somebody in a gas station and they had an EBT card that didn't belong to them. I think that what I see when I go out and meet people are people who've lost their jobs, who have college educations, who are trying to pay a mortgage and feed their families. I see, women with children who are forced to make a decision between taking an $8 an hour job, they can't afford child's care, they can't afford food on that kind of income, making those kinds of choices. So I don't see people gaming the system. I see people that are hungry, that are just trying to provide for their family, just like any of us would.
And I think Craig pointed out earlier that 60% of the SNAP beneficiaries are children. Another 25% are elderly or disabled. So you have 85% of the SNAP population as either a child, an elderly person, or a disabled person. So you know, that tells you that the program is meeting the needs of the people that are eligible. And as Tracy mentioned, we do have a robust quality control system, and it's used to measure the accuracy of the state certification process. We provide bonuses to states who can show low errors and high accuracy. And in fiscal year 10, our accuracy was 96%, and over 98% of those receiving SNAP were, in fact, eligible to receive benefits. So our quality control process is we randomly select cases, and we go and interview the clients, from the federal level, and ensure that they are who they say they were, their income was what they said they were, and it shows that 98% were right and were eligible to receive benefits. The other thing is that the states have a pretty sophisticated program where if someone is working and they don't report it to the state will get an alert on their system from their Social Security number that says, John Smith got a job and he's making this amount of money. Then the state then reaches out to John and says, okay, we know that you're working and now we're going to have to budget that income. So we have the state of Illinois has cross data matches with child support, unemployment. We have a prisoner match, a death match, and it's all technology enhanced, which allows for as the most accurate certification as possible. You may have heard in the news that a few months ago, there was a man in Michigan that won the lottery. And also told the press that he was on SNAP when he won the lottery and he will remain on SNAP. So that was a little bad PR for us. but the thing is that the SNAP regulations and the SNAP rules specifically say that if something can't be anticipated and it can't, and it's not going to be prospective, Illinois and most other states do what we call prospective budgeting. So you look and you say, how much am I going to be making? Well, if you can anticipate that you're going to win the lottery, can you come to my house? So we don't budget lottery winnings because they're not coming in every month and they're not able to be anticipated. They will count as assets. However, Michigan, much like many other states, as Craig has pointed out, has eliminated the asset test. So you have a man that won the lottery and is still receiving SNAP, and that brought a lot of bad PR to our program. But again, that's I think Michigan had over 1 million people on the program, and then there was we don't like the bad PR.
No, and there are really good reasons for the asset
elimination.
Primarily because of people having homes that they're struggling with and they can't sell in this economy. So, one bad case shouldn't change the way that we handle our entire policy on these issues.
Right. Justin, I know you mentioned that you saw corporations and businesses as that third leg to the stool. Can you expand a little bit on what you feel corporations and business role is in fighting hunger and shaping food policy?
Sure. I think that a lot of businesses support charitable groups, whether it's the Salvation Army or Children's Miracle Network. I think first and foremost, it's important to pick a cause, do the research, of course, and then put your full force and weight behind it and all your efforts. I think one of the good things that we did by picking hunger as an issue and then making a commitment and making it a public commitment and saying, we're going to do this over these next few years at this amount of dollars. I mean, we put ourselves out there, and now we need to make good on that, and we are making good on it. I think it's something that a lot of companies could do, and, you know, their foundations might vary in size and scope, but to tackle an issue like hunger, which I think touches so many Americans, is important. The other thing that I was thinking about when you meant the last question, you might have mentioned skeptics. So I think it's important for even for businesses to help turn the skeptics who may be elected officials, turn the skeptics into champions. Low-income people don't have a lot of lobbyists, and nor do kids, but a lot of big companies do have lobbyists. And it's important for us to speak out on these issues, but it's just important, you know, for elected officials to hear from you. If they may be aware of an issue in their district or their region, and they may know Tracy and they may know me, but I think it goes beyond just businesses. I think it goes to a lot of us in this room that find out when your legislator is having a fundraiser in his district or her district, go there, meet them, and talk about this. And if you're not from Eastern Illinois Food Bank, all the better, because you're just making a point. And I think that point needs to be driven home. We can help drive it home, perhaps in Springfield, but I think that everyone can help drive it home with the elected officials.
Right. I think what we're going to do is open up. I know that a lot of you have lots of questions. We're going to try and get to as many of them as we can. If you still have a question, why don't you just hold it up and our volunteers will pop over and grab them. Craig. This question is directed to you. If healthier food were more widely available, would you still be against limiting food choices? Concerned about the childhood obesity epidemic? we have history on this.
There's lots of public health issues in the United States today. From my perspective, hunger is the leading public health issue in the United States. We have millions of... I don't know why that happened. Okay, thank you. We have millions of children in the United States who are going without enough food, and I think this is a public health issue that we need to address. And the SNAP program, SNAP has done a really effective job at doing that. The reason I'm concerned about any sorts of restrictions on food is it is extraordinarily difficult to figure out what are healthy foods and what are unhealthy foods. You look at what was recommended 15 years ago, you look at what's recommended 15 years from now, it's going to be a different set of items that are deemed to be healthy and not healthy. It's difficult to define what's healthy foods. For example, this proposal in New York City, no more Gatorade, okay? A lot of us give our kids Gatorade for their sporting events, but they said that's a bad food to have. Okay, would we want to have some? You know, this I almost said this, but would we want to have people dictating that maybe 2% milk is not acceptable because 2% is not nearly as good as skim milk? Would we want government bureaucrats? Well, I don't like to say it that way because I used to be a government bureaucrat myself. But in other words, would we want people dictating to us what we can eat and what we can't eat based upon all these things? So if we are going to go down that path, and I think we have this, the reason why I'm against limiting what people can eat is because we don't say to government, when I used to work for the government, they didn't say, well, gave you this money, but you can only spend it on X, Y, and Z. Why do we think it's acceptable in our society to talk down to poor people? That we have to condescend to them, we have to insult them, and say, you don't know what's best, we're going to tell you what's best. That's not the world, I mean, that's not how I view hungry, poor people is that we work with them, and so we don't belittle them by saying, you can't eat this, you can't eat that. You know, what if a mother wants to buy cupcakes for her child's birthday party? We're going to say, you can't do that? I think that's why I'm really adamant against these things. If we do insist that we're going to have to go down this path, I'd rather see subsidies. I'd rather say for the following is, if you buy, I mean, can you get a nutritionist to ever say anything's really good? I mean, I guess you could maybe agree that apples are good. Okay, suppose we say apples are good, but somebody would probably object to apples. But suppose we say apples are good. Then we're going to say, if you spend $1 in food stamps on apples, it will only deduct 50 cents in benefits. So we could subsidize it. So instead of punishing poor people for their choices, let's try to reward them. So again, I'm really against insulting poor people. And so that's why I'm against these proposals. But if we do have to go down the path, let's at least subsidize what they're doing.
And I just want to add to that in that the 2008 Farm Bill authorized a demonstration project to look at that very same thing, the subsidies. It's called the Healthy Incentives Pilot, and it's rolling out in Massachusetts before the end of the year, probably December. And basically it's for fruits and vegetables, and it's exactly what Craig said. So let's say you go up to the counter and you spend $10 on fruits and vegetables, they'll only deduct $5 from your SNAP. So we're really hoping that providing incentives to eat healthy foods will be the solution.
Melissa, I think this interests you, might have some as well in the initiatives that you do for SNAP outreach, but this question says, how do you plan to better staff the DHS offices to process benefits in a more timely manner? Outreach workers can get the applications in, but people get discouraged while waiting for benefits.
I would say that's a real problem, and it's something that we've really tackled on the commission to end hunger. We are fortunate to have Grace Ho, the Assistant Secretary, serving on the commission and on the steering committee with us. Sometimes it's painful when we're in those meetings and people start to complain about the local offices and it's 4 or 5 hour waits. But every time that comes up, she's very gracious about it and acknowledges that there's a real challenge. I think IDHS would be the first ones to tell you that they are understaffed, that they have caseworkers with caseloads of 2,700. These are not choices that they've made. They don't want to close offices. They don't want to lay off workers. They would like the legislature and the governor to get them more money so that they have more staff to provide. But there are budget issues that are involved in this. The outreach project is one way that they can help to leverage some of that. Outreach workers help clients put together the information so we have good packages and we're able to follow up and raise these issues at the local level. They're doing two great projects right now. One is a Ford Foundation project where they're doing business process reengineering in some local offices to see if they can change the way that they approach client services to better serve the client. They're also engaged in a framework project where they're reengineering their IT piece of it. There are some significant challenges with the interface right now. I see a staff that is outstanding. Jen Ricina, who was formerly at Shriver Center, is now over the local offices, and they're struggling. And I think it's important that when we talk to our state legislators, we not be shy about saying that it's not acceptable that they underfund these local offices. They provide critical services, and when there aren't people there providing these services, then people suffer.
Thank you. Jason, this is actually directed to you, and I am breaking protocol to start at the bottom. Thank you for what you do, by the way. Now we'll launch into the question. In addition to donating produce to food pantries, Walmart also donates other food products from the corporate side. Some of these products are less than nutritious and put the food banks in a tenuous position of wanting to fill their shelves, but ambivalent about dispensing such products. Is there any movement within Walmart to move towards donating more healthy produce, and how might other corporations be able to do the same? I'll say it again. Thank you for what you do, by the way.
Well, the best approach is to be straightforward. It was a couple of years ago, I was touring a food bank, and I can't tell you what state, and I did see a pallet of cakes or pies or something. And I said, oh, where'd those come from? Well, it came from you. And I was like, well, it wasn't me, but our bakery, you know, like anything else, there's extra bread, donuts, and everything else, but it was put on the truck that went to the food bank. And I had heard this question. I got that question from that food bank director, I remember. And I think we've taken it, it's really about, and this is important, you can't expect the corporate level to drill all of these points down. That's why I'm going to ask for his presentation before I leave here, because I'm going to share it with all of our market managers in this area
so that they can see these numbers themselves. And that's really what it comes down to is, yes, on a corporate level, we have done better at addressing, you know, how many healthy items are being sent. And I think we're doing a better job now that the food banks have the refrigerated trucks to take it. When they didn't, the best we could do was, you know, some of the snacks and the non-perishables. But I think we're getting there. We're not completely there yet, but we're trying to be more conscientious of it, especially here in Illinois and on a local level.
Thank you.
Could I add two things to that, please? First thing is all the more power to Walmart for giving cakes to the food banks. Is we don't know. I mean, this could be a family that's really struggling. Are we going to begrudge them a cake? I mean, really, and that's the thing is, people talk about unhealthy food.
You might have to hire him, by the way.
You know, I'm not going to begrudge that to a struggling family. The kids maybe have been having, might be nice of them to bring home. It might be a nice thing. They go to the food pantry. Oh, you know, Mom, can along with those apples and that other stuff, can you please get us a cake? I mean, that's wonderful. It's a wonderful opportunity. So I don't begrudge this at all. I also wanted I want to say one other more great thing about Walmart. I think we sometimes, this is Walmart Meijer, I'm not restricting this to Walmart. We have to remember that America, we have safe, really affordable and nutritious food. And it's due to the fact that we have this really well-developed food stores across the country that enable us to get safe and affordable foods. So I think that along with their donations to this is we should be happy that Walmart exists to ensure that people have affordable food. I mean, and Meijer and Dominic, but it really is important. So along with, I've done enough praising of Feed America and of FNS, but I also want to pray with Walmart for making sure that we have affordable food.
One of the things too, I mean, it's not, yes, I agree that jelly donuts, you know, I know, but thank you, Craig, for saying that, because let's face it, kids love to have those things, but the real struggle is getting the toiletries and the HBAs to people. That's the real struggle, because you don't see those, you know, the basics, cleaning products. Everyone, when they donate during the summer or Christmas, people are donating cans of corn. No one's thinking, you know, these folks might need, you know, cleanser or toothpaste, toothbrushes. And that's what we've been asked for more than, I think, anything else. Whenever I'm leaving a food bank, that comes up very politely with the directors, like, boy, we would love to see more of this come in. And that's the challenge. That's a piece I think we could grow into still from a retail perspective.
I think food banks have continued to improve the nutritional quality of what they distribute, but it's something we work really hard to do. So every year we're talking about how we get more produce in the system. We've really seen a great increase in the amount of produce, and Walmart gives state giving grants to Feeding Illinois, and we've been able to purchase a great deal of produce and shelf-stable proteins through those donations, and I have one in right now to Jason.
No pressure.
Sure, he's going to look on that
no
favorably. Where we really want to do some more local and organic produce right from our own state as a way both to support our local farmer and to get more healthy foods into our food banks. So it really is that it goes back to that idea of it's a net and it's all sort of woven together. And, you know, it's okay to take some cakes if we're getting enough produce in so that it's just part of the mix. As any good nutritionist will tell you, you know, your diet shouldn't be just all that fast food, but it's okay if it's a little piece of it. So the onus on us is to make it a smaller piece by bringing in more produce and more protein.
Great. So the next question starts a statement. I began the SNAP challenge. Is everyone familiar with the SNAP challenge? How many here took the SNAP challenge? Now, how many of you failed, like me? Okay. Cheated and failed. As quoted in the News Gazette last year, cheated and failed. I was brought as a, you know, the news of the day into my friend's son's classroom. It's great. Cheater and liar. I began the SNAP challenge while in Southern Illinois and completed it here in Champaign-Urbana. I noticed a difference in prices for the same foods, but realized that the SNAP benefits are the same regardless of location in the state. Doesn't this create an additional difficulty for families in more expensive areas of the state? And is there any movement to create an equalizer?
If I can make one brief comment, for those who are interested in differences in prices across the United States, is in the Map the Meal Gap. If you go to different parts of, you can click on different counties to see what the average price for food is in those areas, in case you're interested.
From our perspective, I don't know if anyone's familiar, but we've been moving gradually into Chicago. And I was just at our latest grand opening in Presidential Towers, if you know the Chicagoland area. And we opened up a Market Express. First thing you walk in, all these healthy food, I mean, great looking store. And the first people who walked in were the executives from all of our competitors shaking their heads and going right back to probably take a second look at some of the prices that they had been charging. I think the equalizer can be competition, true competition. When we all are competing for the same customers, you will see the prices equalize. I think that's one solution. Prices do vary in different areas, but the more competition among retailers, the better.
There is different SNAP allotments for people living in Alaska. I think it's just, I assume it's harder to procure food in Alaska. But the way that benefits are calculated, it does not take into consideration cost of living. That's just not one of the eligibility factors in the rules.
Thank you.
I mean, I should point out one thing about difference, if I could just say, but the differences in cost is SNAP benefits fortunately are adjusted for cost of living differences in housing at least. So by the net income, I won't go into the details of it, but so at least a little bit of the cost of living.
Do you have a formula for it?
Well, they do. And so if you live in a higher cost of living area, at least with respect to housing, is you get more benefits, ceteris paribus.
Right. So this question is, how can the system be adjusted to make it, they want to say, easier for supermarkets to donate older produce to soup kitchens rather than to trash it, throw it out?
Are you looking at me or?
Well, you currently are the person who owns the most supermarkets at the table that I know of.
But, well, and here's the thing is we're no longer trashing it. Walmart said, and I'm not trying to make this a commercial for Walmart. It's my example, so that's what I have to use. We want to have zero waste coming out of our stores. That not only includes the cardboard and the plastic hangers, which we're recycling, but it includes food. So when an expiration date is approaching, what we do is immediately get it to the food banks. Now, soup kitchens do receive some product, but for the most part, our largest partnerships are with food banks and some food pantries. I would have to look into it more as to how much we give to soup kitchens, but I mean, overall, that's why we have given away 150 refrigerated trucks. It was the biggest challenge that folks were facing. And they're using those trucks not to just pick up food from Walmart, by the way. They're picking it up from our competitors. But we need more of those, quite frankly, because the food has to be kept fresh all the way through the process. And to get it to the folks who need it, you have to act on it really quick. And our company has got it down to a science now, but it took a couple of years to figure out how we were going to do all this in partnership.
That is, I spoke a little earlier about produce and wanting to increase the amount of produce. Well, produce is really inexpensive to buy. It's not that it's necessarily expensive. It's that the infrastructure for distributing it is challenging. And the way that our current infrastructure is set up, pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, many of them are faith-based organizations that are very small. They don't necessarily have adequate refrigeration. Some of them, you know, don't have a place where we can bring a pallet of potatoes on Tuesday and leave it for them. And in some counties, the distributions are only once a month. So if we get those potatoes in on the 1st and their distribution isn't until the 21st, we have a challenge in where we put that and how we store it properly so that by the time the consumer gets it, it's in an appropriate state. It's something that we continue to work on, and every time we deal with produce, we're not thinking, and this is the challenging thing, because I do procurement, so I say, well, I bought it. Getting it out, that's your magic that you have to do. But it really is the harder part of the equation And so I know food banks, they have such can-do attitudes. I figure if I just keep flooding them with produce, they're just going to figure this out. And next year when we come, we're going to tell you how we worked it out. But that is what the challenge is. So if Walmart gives us a half a truckload of lettuce and that only has a few days on it, well, that's got to get into the food bank. It's got to get sorted. It's got to get sent out to a pantry. Maybe that pantry doesn't have a distribution for a few days. Maybe that soup kitchen isn't open until Saturday. So it really creates a logistical problem in the system, and it's very hard to get that perishable a product to the right place in a timely manner. But it's something that we're up to the task of doing, and I think Jim has a plan.
Well, the refrigerated space, it's not just about the trucks. We've heard from the pantries and the food banks, they need to increase the capacity of their coolers, which are in their warehouses. And that's a lot of the requests that are coming to us are, we have a 15,000 square foot, it needs to be X. Can we help expand it, or we need to move to another facility to be able to meet that part of the demand?
Thank you. This question is just a good one. Can you define TFAP? And I know most of you can do that, but I think, Tracy, you might be better suited to answer the question of why we should support maintaining or incrementally funding for this program.
TFAP is the Emergency Food Assistance Program, and it's part of the Farm Bill. And it was really born out of both a nutrition aspect and also a way to support farm prices. And so it made sense from a lot of perspectives for legislators when they came up with it. And now TFAP is about 30% of the food that's distributed in the state of Illinois each year. So $127 million pounds in FY10 is about 30, 40 million pounds of that was TFAP commodity. And TFAP tends to be produce, protein, really high quality foods. So they've come to be a really important part of that mix. And different food banks struggle with different challenges. Food banks in urban areas have access to maybe more retail, more manufacturing. Some of our food banks are in really rural communities, and they serve very rural populations. They don't have a lot of manufacturing base to go to. They don't have a lot of retail. So TFAP becomes an even bigger part of their equation and what they're providing. In more urban centers with higher populations, maybe you have more people who are capable of giving and supporting their local pantry. But in some of these communities, they're dealing with poverty rates that are just astronomical, and there isn't that kind of capacity. So TFAP has really equalized a great deal some of that distribution and is a critical support to our food bank network.
And a fun fact about TFAP, it stands for, as Tracy said, the Emergency Food Assistance Program. And it's funny because not many acronyms start with the or the. But back in the day when TFAP was first established, it stood for Temporary Emergency Food Assistance Program. And then when Congress made it permanent, they changed the T to a the. Genius, aren't they?
So I know this question actually is a statement, but I'm going to rephrase it in a question. There are studies published by the USDA and others that say SNAP makes an impact on the local economy that far exceeds the number of dollars spent. In fact, the USDA estimates that for every dollar spent on SNAP, $1.79 in economic activity is generated. Can you explain how that can be? Is there an economist in the house?
Yeah, every house should have an economist. Fortunately, my daughter's house has two. My wife is also an economist. It's akin to, you've heard of something called the multiplier effect. That's what it could be thought of. Whenever you bring a dollar into your community, you have to hire people to sell the food. You have to hire people to produce the food. And that's why for every dollar that's brought in, if you bring in another, $10,000 into your community in food stamp benefits, you're going to have to hire more clerks at your store to sell those products. You're going to have to hire more people to bring in the food to your communities. This is why for every dollar that's brought in. And it's something that's, whenever I mention to people, is Illinois should be doing everything in their power to get as much SNAP benefits here. It's free federal money. I mean, it's like building a military base or something in your community. It's free federal money. The state of Illinois spends money on administration, but that's a small component of it. And so it's free federal money that Illinois is leaving on the table if not everybody participates in SNAP. And given this multiplier effect, it's great for communities to have that within there.
Okay, thank you. This is thanks to Eastern Illinois Food Bank for helpful SNAP training last week to enable other social services to increase access for food stamps. How widespread are these efforts to expand the application accessibility beyond DHS offices? Can I take that, Tracy? Melissa, anyone?
As was mentioned before, we FNS administer SNAP outreach. So 50% of what a community-based organization spends on SNAP outreach, the Food Nutrition Service will reimburse. And the efforts are happening statewide. In an ideal world, maybe that's not what would be going on. Maybe the IDHS offices could have the capacity to serve. But what the outreach workers are doing is they're helping people fill out applications. They're telling them what documents they need. They're going over eligibility with them just in case maybe they're not eligible. You know, it will save them the time of going through the process. And there's many organizations, not only in Illinois but in other states, that are participating in SNAP outreach. And it's the three-pronged approach, as I mentioned before, which is the federal, the state, and the community-based organizations.
Thank you. So this question is, what are the best ways for an organization, like a church, to help with hands-on activities, not just giving money? I assume this means to fight hunger.
I'm not sure what the question is. I guess there could be a lot of answers. So if it's provision of food, community gardens are really, no pun intended, cropping up. working with a local school that has a high poverty rate to put a garden in. Research has shown that community gardens and schools and children who work in the gardens really promotes eating fruits and vegetables. So advocacy, but so I have come from an advocacy organization, so I'm going to emphasize that. So I think advocacy is the most important. Those of you who work with people who are hungry can tell those stories powerfully. Your legislator does care. They don't get a lot of calls and they get lonely. So when lots of people call them about a particular issue, they think to themselves that perhaps they should pay attention to it. So when you have the opportunity to talk to your legislator, meet them in district, talk to them about the work that you're doing in their communities and how you're serving their community, and talk to them about the face of hunger. Unfortunately, the hunger is a hidden problem in the United States. Everybody expects it to look like it looks like in Africa, and that's not what it looks like here. It's one of access to nutritious food. So it's easy to go out and buy a huge box of Cocoa Pebbles for a couple dollars, but maybe you live in a food desert and there aren't tomatoes, or the tomatoes are really expensive and mushy, and or you don't, you know, it's a working parent who doesn't have a car and doesn't have time to make a homemade meal. So for lots of reasons, hunger has to do with nutrition and access to good, healthy food. You are on the front line of that, and you can tell your legislator about it. You can also connect if your clients are comfortable through things like the paper plate campaign or going with you to see the legislator. They need to know that it exists in their community, that you're serving those people, and that those people need their help, and that you vote, and you'll be calling them to see how they're doing on those issues you talk to them about. Feeding America has a Hunger Action Center. Right now, we are fighting important fights around the federal budget and around SNAP and TFAP appropriations. So it's an important time to get involved in this. Every year, Feeding Illinois hosts a anti-hunger symposium hosted by Walmart in Springfield, where we get together and we talk with folks from across the state about how we can more effectively address hunger issues. We share ideas, we meet people in other communities, and we also get our talking points, and we go meet with our legislators to talk to them about these issues. So I encourage you, after you leave here today, to get involved in those ways.
Tracy, you mentioned the paper plate campaign. I assume that is not a fight to end Find China. Would you like to speak a little bit more about what that is and how people might participate tonight?
A paper plate campaign. I know Eastern Illinois is doing one right now, and I can't really speak to how they're doing it, but it's typically done with paper plates, and people write their reflections about hunger or their experience with hunger. Jim is holding one up. They probably have some paper plates here that you can share your reflections and your thoughts on. And then we use these. I know I was on an email chain where Cheryl told Senator Durbin staff, you know, we have these great paper plates. If you want to share the story, Senator Durbin's been a real champion on hunger issues. And so they're always looking for ways to share those stories. And, you know, if they could get every congressperson to come in and meet with your clients and your pantries, believe me, they would. But since they can't, they're willing to take your paper plates and you know, sort of force them to look at this issue and to not ignore it.
One more. Are there any discussions at the federal level to update the formula for the federal poverty level and to better match the self-sufficiency level?
I mean, for various reasons, the poverty measure today is outdated. It really hasn't kept up with, the poverty line is, briefly, was established in 1963, and it has not been updated in 50 years, except for inflation. So we know a lot more about poverty. We know a lot more about struggles that low-income families face. And so it would be nice if we could update the poverty measure. I personally am convinced it's never going to be done, because nobody wants to be president when all of a sudden the poverty rate skyrockets. You can explain it to people as much as you want. Oh, the reason why we changed the measure, yeah, that's going to get conveyed to people. So I don't think really that it's going to be ever that measure, unfortunately, probably won't be changed. But there's lots of really neat alternative poverty measures out there, so you can better get a sense of what poverty looks like in the United States. And actually, there's this P60 report, which is the annual poverty reports, where they present some of these alternative measures, so you can see how the distribution of poverty differs depending upon what measure is used.
Well, I just want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. I want to thank our panelists, like I said, two of them who drove down from Chicago just to be here with us this evening. I'd like to thank the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for your tireless fight against hunger in East Central Illinois. Your staff's amazing, and I'm proud to live in a community that has you in it. I would encourage everyone here to not just take this night and have it end here. I think you've heard some things from the panelists about what you can do. I think one of the other things, Craig mentioned, that poverty's silent. And I talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, talk to people you don't usually talk to about hunger and what you've learned tonight. So keep the conversation going, and please keep the conversation going over the delicious treats that Chef Benjamin provided. Cheryl, do you have anything?
I think you've covered it, but I think Brenda and this panel deserves another really strong round of applause for a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much to all of you for coming and for your absolutely wonderful questions. We were inundated by them, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. I do encourage you to stay and chat with the panelists. We can be here until about 9, and there are, as Brenda mentioned, delicious treats and coffee to keep you awake for this last half an hour. So please help yourself. Also, if you want to walk around the perimeter of the room, the paper plate campaign that Tracy was talking about, some of these are on display. We'll be delivering 400 of these plates to Tim Johnson's office on Wednesday to encourage him to protect federal nutrition programs. So some of them are really empowering. I encourage you to read them, and thank you again.